Hi, I'm Brian Pearson. This is The Mystic Cave.
We were born before the wind. Also younger than the sun. And our modern boat was one as we sailed into the mystic.
The Mystic Cave is a sanctuary for the seeker. Stories, conversations, and reflections about the spiritual journey on the other side of Churchland. I'm reading from my memoir, Lost Rites, Leaving Churchland, Chapter 9, Part 2. In this episode, I've moved again. What was this restlessness that kept me moving on? What was I looking for? What was my soul requiring of me? As a minister, I was growing in competence and also in stature, but as a man, I wanted something deeper. I was entering the midlife passage. I awoke on my 40th birthday at sunrise to the sound of singing. It was like a melodic breeze wafting soft and gentle through the window. It took a few moments for Sandy and me to shake off our sleep and confirm that, yes, that's really what it was. We fumbled for our dressing gowns and went to the front door. 12 or 15 members of my congregation, each with a candle and a song sheet and one with a guitar, were bidding me in song to greet the new day. They entered the house, crowding into the front hall. They finished their song, wished me well with warm smiles and softened voices, then went back out again into the morning. Their gift was not altogether bizarre. They were singing the Mañanita, a familiar song sung on the last morning of a Curcio retreat weekend. After an emotionally charged program that included lively singing, talks about personal faith, small group discussion, a call to confession, and the imposition of silence through Saturday night, Sunday morning would begin with a music troupe going room to room, singing softly, inviting the participants, the Curciistas, to arise and welcome the new day. How beautiful is the morning as we come and waken you. With God's early morning blessing, with pleasure we sing to you. When they did that for me at my home, I knew the backstory. They had all risen early, assembled, and traveled in carloads to present themselves on my front porch, composed and peaceful, and all this on a workday. It brought a constriction to my throat, which was as close as I ever got to crying. It was a moment of great blessing, and it went straight to my heart. Then I showered, put on my clothes, and went out the door to get back in the race. The transition 2 years earlier from the Church of the Redeemer in Stony Creek to St. Simon's in Oakville remained a complete blur to me. We attended my mother's funeral, then my sister's wedding, which was hastily rescheduled when my mother ended up dying on their wedding day. We said our goodbyes to our friends at the Redeemer. We bought a house in Oakville because St. Simon's had no rectory. Then we moved, and I started my new ministry. The people at St. Simon's were lovely. Most of them had, as they say, made their Curcio, and many still served in support roles for Curcio retreats offered around the diocese. It altered them individually and as a congregation. It deepened their faith. It brought out their kindness and their thoughtfulness. It gave the church a lightness that made my role easier. I liked being among them. But my busyness beyond the parish had continued to grow exponentially. I was still coordinator of the new ordinands group, NOG, which met monthly. I continued to lead the worship team for the annual meeting of Synod, and sometimes to animate those proceedings as well, as I did 1 year with a talk show format, highlighting the work of the program committee, interviewing program heads as if they were guests on my television show. I supervised the divinity students and assistant curates who were appointed to the parish to assist me. I coordinated a vocations conference for people curious about ordained ministry, and I helped run a weekend showcasing new worship music for the church. And then I was elected as a delegate to General Synod, the triennial meeting of the Anglican Church of Canada. From there, I was appointed to serve on the National Program Committee, from which I was elected chair of the Communications Unit, with its quarterly meetings to coordinate and oversee the National Office's communication strategy. As an offshoot of that, I was invited to join the board of directors for the Anglican Journal, the monthly publication of the Anglican Church, which enjoyed independence from the other communications arms of Church House. It was happening again. Parish ministry itself at St. Simon's was manageable and enjoyable, but one way or another, once again, I was out or away more than I was at home. I tried to have a buddy day once a week with Ben, the other two being in school by then. One day we were sitting together on the couch. Ben wanted to tell me something, but felt I wasn't giving him my full attention. He reached over and took my face in his little hands and turned it toward him as he spoke. He was feeling it too, my absence. Sometimes I tried to bridge the distance between work and home. The boys and I were given a computer game, the hyper-violent first-person shooter called Doom. It wouldn't load on our antiquated home computer, so we snuck over to the church and put it on the computer in the church office. Suddenly, they wanted to go with me to the church, their eyes lighting up. They knew death and destruction were awaiting them there. This time, as my life began to feel once again like a whirlwind, I paid attention to what was happening inside me, at the eye of the storm. The more I consented to do outwardly, the more vacuous I felt inwardly. I was getting recognition for the leadership skills I brought to the church, but for all my efforts, more and more, I was left feeling hollowed out, not filled up. The problem was, I wanted all that outward activity, but I also wanted substance, and I wanted depth. An unofficial motto we used in our communications work at the National Office described what we did as glitz with depth. It was a joke, but it's actually what I wanted. The glitz, the busyness, and the depth, the fulfillment. So I did what any workaholic would do when the plate gets too full. I signed up to take a course. The Jubilee Program in Spiritual Direction was founded by Donald Grayston, an Anglican priest and teacher out of Vancouver. It offered, through various centers across the country, a 15-month program of reading and essay writing on topics relating to the spiritual life, bookended by two intensive residential retreats. I dove into the content of the program, about forms of prayer and meditation, about the psychological foundations of spiritual practice, about the connections between personal piety and social justice, and most of all, about what they called holy listening as a model for spiritual direction or ministry of any kind. I graduated from the program and began applying my new learnings as a spiritual director, seeing directees, and adding that to my regular pastoral load in the church. And then I initiated a monthly meeting of local spiritual directors for group supervision. I even started seeing a spiritual director myself, believing I shouldn't be giving direction if I wasn't also getting it. I know. What was the matter with me? Quite a bit, apparently, and it was only going to get worse. Each month I sent out a memo to the new ordinands group to remind them of upcoming meetings and events. Sometimes I offered something mildly entertaining to amuse them. One month, with a diocesan clergy day coming up, I rewrote Jesus' invitation to fishermen James and John, likening discipleship to an endless clergy day, where political correctness, personality squabbles, biblical fundamentalism, and bruised egos figured highly on the agenda, to which the two would-be disciples replied, "We would rather stick fish hooks in our eyes." Several of the new ordinands took offense at this. They were new enough not to have grown cynical yet about those gatherings. I apologized. But I shook my head at how seriously this new generation of clergy was taking itself in their sparkling white collar tabs. They'd learn. My discontent, like my take on that clergy day, began seeping out in other places too. A new priest was appointed to the fledgling parish in the community next door to ours to oversee the building of a new church there. I wrote to the bishop, "Why not just merge that parish with ours? Surely we didn't need two churches so close together. Why not pool the resources of two into one?" I asked. No one got back to me. Then I was alarmed to see a particular diaconal candidate, a former parishioner of mine in Stony Creek, sailing through the ordination process. I had tried to ring alarm bells in the ear of the bishop. The postulant was a former Catholic, who seemed to me to be more attached to the notion that clergy had power than that they were called to serve. "Hello? Anyone there? Was anyone listening to me?" It was at a clericus that my deepening inner darkness finally spilled out into the light. Our archdeacon announced some changes coming down the pike in the organization of the diocese. Deaneries were going to become regions, increasing the number of parishes and clergy that would gather at meetings such as our own. I was perplexed. I thought the changes were needless, counterproductive, and even stupid. I said so. The archdeacon waited until after the meeting and then took me aside. "What's wrong with you?" he said. "The bishop wants this to happen. Are you going to stand in his way?" It occurred to me that perhaps something was wrong with me. Small irritants were ballooning in my mind into major issues. Sarcasm was creeping into my humor, leaving no one laughing. I was overreacting to situations that had little to do with me. I was angry, and I was getting angrier, but I didn't know the reason why. I might have talked with Sandy about it, but I think by then Reverend Grumpy Pants had successfully pushed her away. Besides, she was dealing with her own work-related stresses, cutting back on her hours to focus on the care of our children. She didn't really want to hear more about me and my problems. I called up someone I thought would be able to help me. Alexandra Caverly Lowry was a former associate professor of dance at York University, a theologian, and a spiritual director. She was one of the leaders of the Jubilee Program in Spiritual Direction, which is where I'd met her. I described for Alexandra my mounting frustration with the church. I put out my hand as if to stop a train, and all the things it demanded of me. I then described all the things I'd rather be doing, rubbing my fingers together as if picking dust particles from the air. She watched my body. "Tell me more about the church," she said, miming my train-stopping gesture. "Now tell me about all these other things you'd rather be doing," imitating my fingers in the air. In a few short minutes, I could literally see my problem, scales falling from my eyes. It would still take a few more sessions to find the words to unpack it and the strategies I would need to move forward, but essentially, it was all right there for me to see. My inner lamb and my inner lion were facing each other for the first time. I had in those days, as I still have today, a lot of energy for a lot of things. My inner lamb, the people pleaser, wanted to say yes to it all. But in my desire to please the church and win for myself a place at the high table, I had been investing everything, all of me, in its committees and its programs and whatever it asked of me. In return, the church had given me precious little back. In fact, it only ever asked for more, and more, and more. Now Leo, my inner lion, was rising up as I put out my hand to say, "Stop!" I needed a creative outlet beyond my ministry. neither my parish nor my diocese took kindly to being treated as my artistic medium, as if they should just conform to some personal vision I had for them. I needed to do something for myself, something that didn't require the participation, the oversight, or worst of all, the permission of anybody else. I needed to choose some pursuits of my own, like picking dust particles from the air, and to follow my muse. And my muse knew immediately where it wanted to lead me, to writing. The seeds had already been planted back in Stony Creek. As a supervisor of divinity students, I was required to meet monthly with a group of other supervisors to coordinate our work and sharpen our skills. One month, our mentor played for us a story on tape. He reminded us of when we were schoolchildren, and our teachers would tell us to put our heads on our desks while they read us a story. I remembered that. Those had been some of my favorite moments ever, of all my moments in school. We didn't have desks to lay our heads upon, but our mentor invited us to sit still and to close our eyes. Then he played for us a monologue by American humorist Garrison Keillor from his PBS radio program, A Prairie Home Companion. The story was called Bruno the Fishing Dog. I'll leave it for you to go find the story for yourself, close your eyes, and be transported to that Midwestern landscape with the aging Lena and Bob and Merlette, her son and daughter-in-law, alienated by the yawning gulf of generations, and Bruno, the family dog, who brings them all together. To say the experience was transformative would be an understatement. To say it reset the course for my preaching would be to give it less credit than it deserves. I was ready to hear that story, and several years later, after I had met with Alexandra, I was ready to start writing stories of my own. So at last, I sat down and began writing. Daniel and Donnie Lucas grew up on a sprawling dairy farm. It would be the first of many short stories to come. Overnight, everything just began to appear sunnier. My sense of humor returned, but without the bite. I relaxed into my ministry. I began preaching like a storyteller rather than a lecturer. I learned to enjoy my people for who they were, not for who my artistic vision needed them to be. I felt like I was breathing again. I was still busy, but at least now I wasn't killing myself. The prophet Isaiah wrote that on the day of salvation, the lion would lie down with the lamb. At last, there would be peace in the land. My conversation with Ted Poulter while I was back in Unionville had galvanized me. He said if I wanted to be taken seriously, I had to get serious. If I wanted my work to be real, I had to be real. Those words haunted me now. But they also gave me a focus. I wanted to be that kind of minister. Someone real enough to be taken seriously. Finally, at St. Simon's, I could feel things turning in that direction. My ministry was about to deepen, but it would be a painful turn. Bernard walked into my office one day right off the street. He was wandering our suburban sidewalks looking for a sign, any sign that would tell him what he and his family were supposed to do next. He had been a successful entrepreneur in Sri Lanka, designing and installing security systems, but the family had to flee when his possession of sensitive security information placed him in the firing line between the government and the Tamil guerrillas. One or the other, he never learned which, blew up his house. Canada looked like a promising destination to Bernard and his wife Chamalee, but their savings were meager and new employment opportunities didn't materialize. The day Bernard wandered into the church, directed by a strong and sudden inner urging, they had reached the very end of their rope. We mobilized a small group of willing volunteers from the parish to help them. This brought the family some immediate relief, both materially and in moral support, until their real problems began. Their eldest daughter, entering her teens, was asked by her teacher at school to write a personal essay. A few pages would have sufficed, but hers rambled on, page after page, the handwriting changing erratically as the images grew darker and more bizarre. The content was disturbing. The school consulted with a social worker from the Children Aid Society, or CAS, who recognized the signs of a mental disorder. A psychiatrist confirmed that hunch, calling it a psychotic break. But a second social worker saw something more sinister. It's unclear why, but the CAS, acting on the suspicions of the second worker, removed the girl from school, suspecting some sort of abuse at home. Without consulting the parents or arranging an investigation, the CAS placed her in temporary foster care. When the parents were informed, they were beside themselves. They didn't understand how this could happen. They were alarmed about their daughter's mental state. They said that theirs was a peaceful and loving home, incapable of producing the kind of insinuation being made. There was no abuse, they said. The time I had spent with them in their home confirmed this, but still, one had to keep an open mind. In foster care, their daughter became distraught. She attempted suicide and was admitted to the psychiatric ward of a downtown hospital. Bernard and Chamalee, who were under suspicion as abusers, were denied visitation rights, though I was allowed to see her as an intermediary. They were told instead, if they simply admitted to any wrongdoing in the home, their daughter could be returned to them. Something was seriously wrong with this picture. I sought an appointment with a local CAS director. He couldn't divulge any details from their file, he told me. But that didn't stop him from pointing out that this family was, after all, from, where was it again? Sri Lanka. Maybe they do that sort of thing there, he said, without specifying what he meant by that sort of thing. I went to see the mayor, who is also a member of our congregation. I explained my concern. It appeared to me that the parents were being denied a fair hearing, including a full investigation into the intimations of abuse. The family, who had already suffered in their flight from Sri Lanka, was being torn apart by this. She offered only her view that where there's smoke, there's fire. I learned later that she was a personal friend of the CAS director. Bernard sacrificed his job search to get his daughter back. He wrote letters, he researched family law, and he appealed to anyone who would listen to his story, attracting the attention of the media. W5, CTV's current affairs program, came to interview the family, and also me, asking all the right questions, but to no avail. It would be years before Bernard and Chamalee would be reunited with their daughter. She made several more attempts on her life, and her mental health continued to deteriorate. Schizophrenia had run in the family, Bernard tried to tell the authorities, one generation back. But that one rambling essay provided all the evidence some people needed. When you're a hammer, the saying goes, every problem looks like a nail, and I could do nothing to make it right. Another opportunity to deepen my work came to me in my new role as spiritual director. What I didn't know about counseling and therapy was a lot. But I had taken a course. I'd read some books. How hard could it be? Just give the person your undivided attention. Listen for the deeper movements and love unconditionally the soul who's trying to emerge. The woman was 20 years my senior, with two adult sons and a retired husband. She had grown up in the church. Nothing was more important to her than her love for God and her love for her family. But her love for herself wasn't even on the list. As these things tend to work, her soul was angry about it. In my office, where we would meet every other week, she would often weep, sobbing convulsively. She couldn't identify where the sobs were coming from. Something about our time together would bring on the flood, and her words would get lost in her tears. The simple act of paying attention was water to her parched soul. When she rose to leave, she would sometimes cling to me as if she was going directly from me to her execution. I could see patterns and even possible reasons for her inner torment. But what did I know? I wasn't her analyst. I wasn't even a psychologist. I was just a hopeful priest giving her some space for her spiritual growth. But I could feel the grip of her nascent dependence on me. She was like a drowning woman with her arms around my neck, tightening her hold, pulling me down. The more desperately she drew me in, the more I struggled to break free, to keep my head above water. I had no doubt that she was capable of working through for herself whatever it was her soul required of her. But I also knew that, trying to help her, I was seriously out of my depth. I suggested she see someone else, perhaps a woman, perhaps a more experienced therapist, but she wasn't having it. I was the one to whom God had directed her, she was certain of that, and I was the one she chose. I remained on the hook. These attachments were difficult for me. I cared deeply for Bernard and for his family, as I did for the woman who came to see me for spiritual direction, but I felt inadequate in each instance. I wasn't able to give Bernard his daughter back, and I wasn't able to give the woman the self-love she lacked. All I was able to do was be present, to listen, and to accompany them on their painful journeys. Yet, miraculously, that seemed to be enough. Not my knowledge, or my skill, or my wisdom, just my presence. To this day, I'm grateful for the privilege of walking with them. It changed us all. My presence wasn't enough, however, to change things at home. Sandy was tired of life feeling so hard, our troubled finances, our hectic life, our distance from her parents. She wanted to go home, to Calgary. So I began exploring job possibilities there. When nothing materialized, I shifted my attention to the coast. That would at least get us closer. But by then, I was dug in pretty deep at St. Simon's. After 6 years, leaving would not be easy. I've been reading from my memoir, Lost Rites, Leaving Churchland. Thanks for sticking with me. Hopefully, parts of my story are also parts of yours, especially as we look back together upon those difficult and demanding midlife years. If you'd like to share something of your own story, please leave a post in the Facebook group, The Mystic Cave, or write to me personally at mysticcaveman53@gmail.com. In the next episode, I return to the land of my roots. But we can never go home again. So it carried me even deeper into my search for my heart's true home, which isn't a place at all. Down we go. I'm Brian Pearson. This has been The Mystic Cave. It's too late to stop now.